Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Okay, this week is a special podcast. For the first time, I'm having multiple guests in a single conversation. Stephanie Barba-Hammer, you'll remember that she is an author of Magical Realism. Check out her new book, Pretend Plumber. We also have Ian McGinnis, who specializes in medieval Scottish history, and Jan Doolittle-Wilson, who specializes in history, gender, and disability studies. Today we are talking about Catelyn's ninth POV chapter. It's such an important chapter. And this chapter, more than any other, sets up the Red Wedding. If you're looking for my conversation with Steve, that will be published next week. I will also mention that Steve and I will be doing a season one recap of Severance over at Cocoons of Horror. So search for that wherever you search for podcasts. Here is my conversation with Steph, Jan, and Ian.
Hi, everybody.
Great to meet you, Jan.
Nice
your book looks
you
amazing.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
This
nice
is
to meet you both.
This is exciting for me because I love talking with you all, and I think that you might enjoy talking with each other, but that's always sort of a risky proposition. So many things could go wrong, and I've never had more than one person on this podcast. And I was talking with Sarah earlier today, and I was thinking, you know what? I probably should have, like, tried these things incrementally, like maybe like two people first and then three, and then try to negotiate four different time zones.
Aren't you the one who likes to climb the chaos ladder?
I do, but here's what we're gonna do. I think we need a more organized approach for this. So
I was just thinking that, Jan. I was thinking about the chaos ladder too. Yeah. And going, is there room for four on there,
right,
on those rungs?
But that's what's going to make it wonderfully chaotic, I think, right? Just plunge in.
So here's what I'm gonna do. I have three cards. All right.
Ooh.
So, and they're hearts representing my undying affection. And Steph, your ace is with me. I met you first.
Oh.
And Jan, you're number two. And Ian, you're number three. And so after I do my synopsis, I will just draw one of these cards. And then the floor will be yours. I think Ian, in the outline you sent me, you used the term roundtable. And I thought, roundtable sounds so much better than panel discussion.
I thought that's what you'd called it.
Did I say? Well, maybe I'm complimenting myself. I saw that. Ooh, I like roundtable. That sounds so much better. All right, wonderful. Okay, here's my synopsis. As Catelyn marches south with Rob's army, she wonders if Rob is prepared for what is ahead. She hears that several Lannister scouts have been found and killed. She also hears that the Lannisters have bested and cornered her brother's forces. But chief among her worries is the ever-cantankerous Walder Frey. Rob's army needs to cross the river, and the only way over is to negotiate with the Freys, who have held the bridge for 600 years. Rob and company are met by several Frey men who invite the boy lord for supper. This, all agree, is a very bad idea, as Walder Frey could easily use Rob as a trading chip with Tywin. When Kat sees these negotiations are going sour, she steps in and volunteers herself for the task. Then Kat goes to treat with the old pink weasel. Walder Frey, it seems, hates everyone, but he especially hates Tullys and Lannisters and other families that refuse to marry their sons and daughters to the Freys. After a long monologue of grievances, Kat can see what the old man wants. She returns to Rob, informing him that a deal is on the table. They can cross the bridge if the Starks will take several Frey children with them. Included in the deal is a promised marriage between Rob and a Frey girl. Rob agrees, and the army crosses. All right, here we go. And the card is a three. So, Ian McGinnis, would you like to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the... You and the group, you and the round table, climb the ladder of chaos?
Well, we're discussing how chaotic that might be.
A lot of chaos today. A lot of chaos.
No, I think one of the themes for me that came out of it was the theme of kind of loyalty and faith, right, and lordship, all of those things kind of intertwined together, and the extent to which that's seen and indeed not.
Loyalty as opposed to what Walder Frey is sort of represents.
Well, I suppose, I mean, Walder might say that he's been, as he does to Catelyn, he's been perfectly loyal to the crown, and ultimately that's where his ultimate loyalty should lie. If he thinks that to be loyal to his lord is to commit treason, then that's not loyalty at all, surely. His bond to the crown is surely stronger than that to his lord, although, yeah, in a medieval sense, that might be queried, but I think it speaks to the complexity of it when you have a family or a group of families going up against the crown, and when that group particularly thinks it's been hard done to, and so it feels that it's justified in the action that it's taking, and then you're left to decide which side are you on and who's right.
Is that really the sense you're getting from Frey here? I don't know if he cares about loyalty at all.
Oh no, I don't think he does, but I think he's portraying himself that way.
Sure.
That he's at least trying to suggest that he's walking trying to walk a kind of middle ground. Yeah. But I think he's also representative, or potentially representative, of how other families are faced with a choice. And we know that there are those within the Stark camp who will be equally problematic, you know, in chapters and books to come when it comes to that loyalty, and they may be swayed by various reasons, not least of which is money, but there is a political choice we made here, and Frey, you know, Frey's out for whatever he can get, but he's also put in this position where he has to make a choice.
And then of course loyalty is a big deal relative to how Rob is playing politics with the, you know, different people riding alongside him, gathering information from different folks, in a way showing loyalty to his mother in a way that maybe other lords might not have to worry about.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, who are they actually being loyal to? Are they being loyal to Rob? Are they there because they're loyal to his father? Or does Catelyn actually have a greater role to play in all this than is perhaps recognized or seen? You know, are they actually loyal to her because she's effectively representing her husband? You know, it's who is that loyalty to, and what is it based on? It's based on the personal relationship between them and Ned, but these men, hardly any of them will have a relationship with Rob. They'll probably know Catelyn, being, you know, the Lady of Winterfell, far more than they know Rob. So actually,
right,
that loyalty may be to her as an extension of her husband rather than to her son.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about loyalty too. I mean, clearly that's, you know, the major theme here of the chapter, and in many ways the book, right? Because trying to figure out who is loyal to whom and what loyalty is the strongest. You know, I kept thinking as I was rereading the chapter, divided loyalties. Right. There are lots of different kinds of loyalties, even among, you know, the same members of the house, even within one individual. And so, you know, I think, Ian, you're right. When you take a look at somebody like Frey, you know, he is clearly somebody who really is just loyal to his own interests. That's kind of how you can figure him out. Right. He will basically fall in with whomever he can get the most advantage from. Which I think obviously makes him super dangerous, you know, among other characters who kind of do the same thing. One thing I wrote in my notes is never trust or make an alliance with somebody who feels like they have been slighted by you. And I think there are several characters that they make these alliances with that then comes back to haunt them, obviously. And it's not just Frey, it's, you know, Theon, obviously, Littlefinger. But then I was also thinking about Kat's position as well as Rob's position. And what different loyalties do they try to honor, but they can't do it all? And this is a big part of the problem, right? So just in my notes, I put down, you know, Kat is faced with, do I go home to Bran? Do I tend to my son? Do I protect my children in the North? Or do I stay with Rob? That's a really big decision that she has to face. Of course, her loyalty is, Rob, we have to go rescue the girls. this is a driving force for her. You know, that has to be our top priority. And then Rob's in a position later on where, is it going to get the girls giving up a key hostage in that attempt, or is it sticking with the larger objective, right? And then of course, Kat makes that fateful decision later on, not to get into later chapters, but where is her loyalty? Is it to, again, getting the girls back, or is it remaining loyal to Rob and following his orders? So all of these little things that are threaded really from the beginning of the book, and certainly you see evidence of this abundantly in this chapter, really has to do with this idea of where will my loyalties fall?
Mm-hmm.
Reading this chapter for the, I don't know, third time, I really enjoyed the conversation between Frey and Catelyn. That's really the piece that really excited me. As a novelist who writes very short books, I'm in awe of Martin's ability to write these huge books with these characters who are very detailedly drawn. And I'm particularly impressed by that discussion and at Frey's, as you put it, Anthony, this list of slights that goes on for quite a long time. It's more than a page, that are very detailed, very specific.
Yeah.
And on one hand, I'm struck by how he's a villain, of course, but how human he is and how we recognize that feeling of being slighted. We've all been slighted at some point in our past, and perhaps we have our own list of slights. I certainly do. And I love how he's treacherous and worrisome, but also completely human.
Yeah.
And the outline of those slights makes him, at least for a moment, if not sympathetic, then certainly relatable.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the other sort of piece to that I really admire is that he is telling Catelyn this in private, which means that he feels comfortable talking to her in a way that he doesn't necessarily talk. He's much gruffer in the public part of that conversation. And that speaks to her incredible abilities as a diplomat.
Absolutely.
She's able to be very aggressive with him. We want a cross, and you swore an oath to my father and all of this. But then she's also be able to create enough safety that he can say, well, yeah, it's loyalty. Yeah, it's money. But it's also, I'm really hurt and pissed off about all these things that your family has done. So there's a human side, I guess, to the issues that you've been outlining, Ian, in terms of how families behave in the Middle Ages and what about divided loyalties, Jan. There's also this, I, Walter Frey, feel, I'm going to use a Yiddish word, beleidigt. I feel hurt. I feel humiliated. And I feel safe enough to tell you, Catelyn, about this so you can maybe fix this. And that's the amazing, for me, just the amazing part of this chapter.
She's almost the perfect person to negotiate, because what does Walter Frey really want? He's been sitting there waiting for decades upon decades to get back at the Tullys. Right? He doesn't really care about the Starks. He really doesn't care. So here's Kat. She comes in. Aha, finally, I'm going to exact my toll from one of these Tullys who thinks that they're better than I am. Right? So he really wants his vengeance in a, you know, sort of a very mundane way, if you think about it. But he wants vengeance against the Tully family. And of course, Kat represents the Tullys in this conversation. So in addition to sort of being savvy enough to let Walder be high and mighty when he needs to be high and mighty, she's also smart enough to know, now, I don't just represent the Starks here. I represent the Tullys, and I know what he wants. And I can give it to him, right? And she has the authority as the mother.
Right.
She has the authority to give a thumbs up on these marriage arrangements, right?
Yeah, because I mean, it would normally be, oftentimes it is the mother that's involved in negotiating these things. It's not just the father that's involved, or indeed that the mother may be involved in arranging and then arranging the actual ceremony and things. So there is often a heavy female and motherly component in that. Now, the other thing I was just going to say was, though, I think, though, in that representation of Caelan, that you can see that she's not a Stark, or she is different to Ned, because I think Ned would take the more practical line that, you know, Frey should be loyal or not. Frey should do as I tell him to do, or I'll pull his castle down. And I think you can kind of see that in Rob, and perhaps what you're seeing in Caelan is the other route that she has a bit more practicality to her. And ultimately, Ned's rather old-fashioned view of things is what leads to his downfall. Caelan is far more practical in that sense. And I suppose it's the extent then to which she passes that on to her children, not just her sons, because I think in the shape of her daughters as well, as the story will play out, I think that's quite important.
All right, so I'm going to draw another card. And we have ourselves an ace. And that's you, Steph.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Well, gosh, I am torn between character and plot. So let me go with character, because something, again, that I noticed on this reread was the role of Theon in the early sections of the chapter. And I was interested, again, Martin is so good at very efficiently creating these contrasts. I was fascinated by the contrast between Caitlin's reactions and behavior and Theon's. And Theon, who is smirking all the time and is speaking in this cocky way about these life and death situations.
Yeah, I think that he's described at one point as easy confidence.
Easy confidence. And it seems so jarring and so it's so misplaced when you've got the, you're trying to move these vast armies and we're in this drastic situation of having to try to negotiate to cross this river. And there he is going, oh, the ravens have already been taken care of course, and we'll show him, and I'll bring you some feathers for a hat. He makes some comment to, to Caitlin, and I just love him. And of course, those of us who've read the books know what is in store for him. As a character, he functions so beautifully to throw into relief the statescraft of Caitlin.
That's right. That's
that
right.
She's saying, no, that's not right. No, it's more complicated than that. It's this.
Yeah. Yeah. He's really kind of, if you think of Rob as sort of the cartoon character with the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other shoulder, you know, like Theon's basically on one shoulder saying, hey, just tear it down. Just, you've got the bigger army. Use the bigger army. Of course, I think Theon thinks that his aspirations are improved the sooner the Starks go to war. But of course, you don't know that about him right at this point. And of course, Caitlin's on the other shoulder saying, maybe words, not swords in this case.
Right.
Martin doesn't often do monologues. At least in this book, he doesn't do monologues. It's normally these short, pithy, you know, think of anything that Tyrion says, or think of like the pithy wisdom of Ned Stark, or, you know, the sort of the coy idiom that Varys will throw in or something. Not a lot of monologues, but Walder Frey gets at least two solid pages of monologue in this. And I wonder, as an author, are you aware of the such things like, this person's got too many words? Can I convey this idea for this character in a different way?
That's such a great question. And that actually leads me into thinking about some of the sort of plot construction of this chapter. So thank you for that. That this is actually a very talky chapter. There's a lot, it's all conversations. And Martin is such a skilled storyteller that he's able to make those conversations feel very dynamic. And he does that, it seems to me, in the first part by having all this camping and decampment and horseback riding going on during these various conversations. And he doesn't describe that really. He just has a sentence every once in a while. They broke camp the next morning. Somebody gets off his horse, and then Caitlin, I think I'm making her a Californian by calling her Caitlin, so apologies for that. Caitlin, at a certain point at the end of her teaching moment with Rob, gallops off, and you realize, oh, they've been riding this whole time.
Right.
So there's a kind of, he brilliantly reminds us very quickly that they're moving all the time. This conversation is, they're not at a round table like us. They're right on the road. They're putting up tents. They're taking things down. And Martin is able to create a similar feeling of dynamism in the Frey Catelyn conversation. And I don't know how he does that. I think it's the power of the voice. And again, this is something that as a creative writer, I always am struggling towards this. Can I get the voice right? Because if you can get the voice right, you can go for a page and a half.
Right.
I mean, Hamlet's soliloquies, they work because Hamlet's voice is amazing. And we're just like, okay, speak the speech I pray you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just tell me what you're going to do. And that Frey monologue, it is indeed a monologue, is so powerful. I think because it's so personal and so specific. you know, this happened, and then this happened with, you know, my, the, you know, this daughter and this son. And I, at one point he said, I forget which son that was, because he's got so many of them, but I think it's this one. And the power of that voice is, I think, what carries us through. So long answer to your question, but I really appreciate that question.
Yeah, and I think it's necessary, because so much of what makes that character work is the sense that he has been slighted so often. And you get that sense, like, he's got all the power in the room, but he feels so insecure. Like, no one is going to stroke this guy's ego. Nobody. And it just, all, Cat just can be that little salve to these many wounds that he has developed over the years.
I don't know if other folks felt this, and I'd be curious to know what you thought, Ian, and what you thought, Jan. But when I read this, that monologue again, I thought, he's that kid in the class that no one likes.
Yes, yes. I kept thinking, Stephanie, again, as I was rereading, be careful how you treat people who are so-called inferior to you, right? Because I think there are several times the characters who are in greater positions of power really underestimate the power itself of grievance, right? We keep coming back to that word, but I was with you when I read through that passage. I kept thinking, he is telling her pretty much everything she needs to know. And that long list of grievances, right? I will just put it out here and tell you exactly how I feel. My children weren't good enough, you know, for the errands and the tollies. I mean, he just goes on and on. He pretty much tells her everything she needs to know. And it says so much about what motivates him. He really is a person almost completely motivated by a sense that he has been dismissed and ridiculed and overlooked and slighted his entire life. And this is his moment, right? Suddenly now you need me. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to make the most of this because I've got you in my audience and I will hold you captive to my list of grievances.
Right.
Absolutely.
I almost feel like that's the bigger issue, that he finally has the audience he's always wanted. Like who cares about, he doesn't, can't even remember the names of these grandchildren. So who cares who gets sent off where, but he wants someone to listen, you know, God damn it. I've been saving this speech for the last 50 years and finally someone's going to sit here and listen to me talk. So I think that there's a part of that. And I don't think Rob would be able to be that person for him. He really needs a Tully with power in the room, right?
And I suppose ultimately as well, that sense of grievance will continue. And the combination of that, and of course the corner that he's painted Rob into by the negotiation of the marriage, is what will be the Stark's downfall ultimately.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, so I think that that's what makes, I mean, look, the chapter is interesting just because of what it's doing in the book. Mm. Right? This is the first chapter that I actually felt like, go get that damn map. Because, you know, all of these other chapters,
I referred to the map several times.
Right. So there's enough on the page that you can, like, totally get character oriented. But this was the first chapter where I thought, I absolutely need a map to figure out what's happening here. There's major pieces moving around.
Yeah.
So it's important in that way. At the same time, it's impossible to read this chapter without thinking about the Red Wedding, right? So, yeah. So I don't know if that's something we want to talk about. Well, let's save that just for a little bit. So, Jan, what did you want to talk about today?
I have, like I said, I took several notes, but based on Stephanie and Ian, I kind of want to build off what they've been talking about. Because one thing I wrote down, especially when Stephanie was talking, is when people show you who they are, believe them.
Sure.
And it seems that there are so many moments, you know, even in preceding chapters, where Catelyn has a great deal of evidence that these are the people whom she's dealing with, and yet still, I think, actively chooses to believe the best. There are even times throughout this chapter where she says, I'll just kind of pretend the lie because it's easier to do that than to reckon with the idea that this might be a really, really bad idea, what I'm about to do. Even as she's telling Rob, oh, I will go talk to Frey. He won't hurt me. Family loyalty will be more important to him. In the back of her mind, she's even thinking, I will just choose to believe that this is true. And yeah. maybe it will be true.
Yeah, she says, on her lips it says, he's known me since I was a child. He'll bring me no harm. And then what she doesn't say out loud is, unless there was a prophet involved in bringing me some harm.
A prophet,
right? Yeah. So she has she that dual mind about him, right?
Right. And going back to Ian, you know, you were kind of comparing Catelyn to Ned in terms of how they operate. And I think one thing that the two of them tend to have in common is, again, their belief that people operate in the world according to the kind of same rules that they do. And so, you know, if you think back to the early conversation, very early in the book, where she gets Lysa's letter.
Mm.
And Ned says to her, oh, you can't really believe what this letter says. Lysa's not in her right mind. Her husband has just died. And she's, oh, no, no. I've known Lysa since I was, you know, a child. And this is what I choose to believe about Lysa. We could talk all day about Littlefinger, right? Kat continues to believe that deep down, you know, Littlefinger may have his flaws, but he's loyal to me. He's always been loyal to me. Here's another person who is living off of a slight. Right? Littlefinger has yeah. never forgotten how he wanted Kat's hand. And of course, he was defeated in the duel with Ned's older brother. He has never forgotten that. That's a big part of his kind of mentality as he goes through the narrative.
Yeah.
But yet she goes on Littlefinger's word that this is the dagger, right? That belonged to Tyrion that he won at the tourney. She chooses to believe that this information is correct because Littlefinger wouldn't lie to me.
Right.
So she operates this way a lot throughout the book, choosing to believe that people will do the right thing ultimately, right? That family loyalty will win out. Loyalty to your liege lord, you know, loyalty mm-hmm. to these bonds that we have established through our pasts. And time and again, these are the kinds of assumptions that prove sometimes disastrously not to be the case.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of goes back to in part to what I was stumbling over before. But I think the Starks are portrayed as kind of old-fashioned, that they have these beliefs that have no place in a modern world in which people couldn't give a rat's ass for as Waldo says, you know, I make lots of oaths, doesn't mean I know what I actually said. But everyone has that very practical, cynical view of the world, and Littlefinger is the obvious example as well. But everyone largely works that way, except for the Starks. The Starks still stick to that noble ideal. They have very firm ideas of loyalty and chivalry and all the rest of it. And they're almost like they're out of step with the rest of society. And that's how they get done in the end, because no one else is playing by the same rules there.
And I wanted to bring up this idea of the Red Wedding, Anthony. I know you want to maybe reserve that conversation,
no, let's have it.
I just kept thinking, and I would love to know what others believe about this, but I, you know, so many commentators and fans and scholars have written so much about that. This is the moment, right? That Catelyn makes this deal. Rob agrees to marry a Frey daughter. Mm-hmm. Rob then later breaks that pledge. And this is what causes the Red Wedding. I'm not entirely convinced that even if Rob had gone through with his oath, Frey wouldn't have done exactly the same thing. So it kind of goes back to your point, Ian, about they're still operating in this set of circumstances by which if we follow through on what we promise, everybody else will follow through on what they promise. And I'm not convinced that would have been the case, even if Rob had kept his word.
It's a good question. What do you think about this, Ian?
I was going to say, I mean, I think it's potentially even worse than that, because it's not just, I mean, Frey, you kind of expect to let you down, I suppose, or you know, the audience does. Martin is setting up the Starks to fall anyway, so there has to be a, you know, there is a logic to Frey turning his back on them. I suppose the ultimate one in that sequence is Bolton. It's Bolton's treachery from within that is the key one in regards to the Red Wedding, and that's the one they really don't see coming, because he's a loyal bannerman. He has sworn his loyalty to the Starks. He has campaigned with them and all the rest of it. And so he should be who they can count on. And of course, he's the one that literally does stab them in the back. And yeah, I think that's the real killer blow. That's the one they don't see coming.
Hmm.
That's These are great points, you guys, and it's kind of taking me back again to thinking back about the Frey monologue. And I guess another little sort of just human piece to this is, people, if someone has that many grievances, can you ever fix that? Because there's always another grievance. They're in grievance mode. So I think, Jen, your point that, you know, even if the marriage had gone through, because there's always something. Because for someone like that, it can't be fixed, not like that. So that betrayal, but you know, betrayal is in the future, one way or another. And I loved the discussion about Caitlin and Ned and this kind of old-fashioned view of nobility and how they're out of step, which I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think that's absolutely right. And it explains again a little bit the brilliance of having the Ned in prison chapter right before the Caitlin chapter. Martin's great at creating those sort of structural parallelisms. She's not undone yet, but there's a real danger to the old-fashioned way.
Right. One little thing that I learned in this giant encyclopedic World of Ice and Fire book that came out about 10 years ago. In the North, they take very seriously this idea of guest right. Bread and salt and a guest under your roof, that is sacred. It's so sacred that it's a taboo that's as ingrained as any other taboo that you'd find. In the South, not so much. Not so much. So, Ian, you were nodding vigorously. Did you have something to say on that one?
Sorry, no, I was just thinking of where I am. And I think that ties into, you know, that idea of Highland hospitality and that idea, you know, thinking of like the early modern, the massacre in Glencoe, the McDonald's, let the camels in, then feed them and give them a shelter for the night, and then they kill them in their sleep. You know, it is the thing that is not done. And yes, I think that's it. I think obviously Marshall is using quite a broad historical canvas, but I think that has particular resonance with where I live at the moment.
So the Red Wedding seems to have an analog to a couple of such events in Scotland, right?
No, and one of the other classic examples it's based on is probably the Black Dinner, where James II of Scotland is involved in the murder of one of his own nobles, stabs him despite having invited him in, given him a safe conduct to turn up, and then proceeds to stab him, and then watches as his entourage kill the Earl of Douglas and his brother in front of him. So yes, these things do happen, and you can put all your checks and balances in as much as you want, but if somebody has an axe to grind, if somebody gets het up, if there's an argument, if it's done in hot blood, you know, these things can happen. I think the Red Wedding is far more premeditated. It is very, yeah. The starts walk into the trap and that's it. And I think that one's a bit more, maybe a bit less likely to happen, I suppose, historically, but that doesn't mean it won't happen.
So I guess the question for me is, why are those stories told? Because is it told to continue to, like, don't trust that clan? That clan's not to be trusted because this is what they did. Or is it told because you say, actually, you're not supposed to trust anyone in the way that we used to, because people don't really adhere to guest right anymore. Like, what's the purpose of retelling a story like that, do you think?
I mean, I suppose in part it is about memory. It is about ensuring that these things are not forgotten. I mean, there are popular tales that people would say in this in the Highlands that you know, there are still McDonald's who will not engage with members of the Campbell family, and that's a good few centuries later.
Is that real? I had never heard this before.
Supposedly, okay, yes. Right. I don't know any offhand, okay. but it is talked about in those terms. But no, I mean, I think it is about the betrayal. It is about the fact that, you know, the normal way of doing things has been torn up and has been ignored, and that this isn't the way things are supposed to be. And you know, it comes back to the starts again, that idea of this is how society mm-hmm. is, but actually society isn't that way, or it doesn't have to be that way. These rules are not rules, they're customs, and such things can more easily be broken.
Right. And Rob really represents kind of that northern sentiment that, what's the issue here? He's a bannerman to your father. This should be easy. And then Kat responds with, well, some men keep their oaths better than others. So she's the southern politician in this conversation. And she knows that it's not going to work. That, and of course, your point, of course, Ian, was that, you know, Roose Bolton is a northerner, and he seems to be the chief betrayer in this event. I wanted to ask, and this is just for anyone, I wanted to ask this question. There's this conversation between Kat and Walder about where the Arryn boy was to be fostered, and it's repeated twice. And it's almost like Kat's trying to put this together, and it seems significant to her, but it never seemed significant to me until this read. To think, why does she care about this point? There's so much else going on right now. Why are you sticking on this point, Kat? So I'm curious to hear your take on this.
I want to know the answer to that, too, because I don't know.
I had to go back and look because it bothered me, too, Anthony. I thought... I know this is important. This is not in here for no reason.
Yeah.
But I don't remember why this is important. And so I scoured back through the book and came to the realization that it's Martin's signal to the reader that something's off here, right? What Kat believed to be true is not really true. And that, again, some of the people she might have trusted aren't to be trusted. The information she received maybe isn't reliable. And it really points the finger back, right, to, no pun intended, to Littlefinger and Lysa and what's going on with their relationship. And then, of course, we eventually find out mm-hmm. who murdered John Arryn. It really goes back to that very earliest moment in the book where Robert comes to visit at Winterfell. They're in the crypts. He tells Ned, I loved John Arryn. I'm devastated he died. I felt it was my responsibility to at least care for his son, young Robert. Mm-hmm. I wanted to send him to Tywin. God forbid, right? But I wanted to send him to Tywin to basically make a man out of him, is what he implies, that, you know, Robert's too soft. He's sickly. Right. I'll send him to Tywin. He'll learn how to be a proper lord. And of course, Lysa grabs Robert and flees for a number of reasons, but partly because she doesn't want the Lannisters to get her son. And she also knows that she's complicit, right, in what's happened to John Arryn. But then she's told by Frey, actually, the boy was going to be sent to Stannis.
Right.
And so, again, it's our first hint that John knew something was up, wanted to protect his son, didn't want his son to go to the Lannisters. He, of course, had found out about the incestuous relationship between Cersei and Jaime. And so to protect his son, he's going to get his son out of there. Send him to Stannis where he thinks his son will be protected. And so that's how it all starts. We don't know any of this yet as an audience, but that's our first hint that something happened in King's Landing. Something's off with Lysa. Lysa, of course, you know, Kat visits her for the first time in years at the Vale. Lysa's very different. She's seems to be paranoid, extremely overprotective of her son. Doesn't give her soldiers, which is kind of shocking to Kat. That we're asking you to raise your bannermen, help us wage this war against the Lannisters. And Lysa says, no, we're good. We're staying here. I need my soldiers to protect my son. Yeah. So there are these little hints throughout that. Why is it so key for Lysa to have this kind of protection to the point where she's not going to give her own sister and her own nephew the soldiers and men that they need?
And it could be that, you know, she wasn't happy with anything that was going on in King's Landing anyway. But the second someone said, we're taking your son away, it's like, all right, where's the poison? Because I didn't like the situation anyway, and I'm not really a fan of any of these people, and I might not even like my husband that much. The second someone suggests that Sweet Robin goes somewhere else, she starts to conspire to end Robert Arn.
Yep.
So I think that that may be a key motivator for Lysa.
And it leads to maybe a discussion we could have about another huge theme of the chapter and indeed the book, which is, again, never underestimate the determination of a mother to protect her children.
Sure.
Because sure. She will commit the worst crimes to preserve those children. And you certainly see that with Lysa. You see it with Kat. You certainly see it with Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, motherhood in this world is one of the only means of power for women in a society that is very much dominated by men. Have sons, have those children. That's your, you know, kind of indirect link to the power that your household has, or that your husband has, or your king has.
Mm-hmm.
But you mess with those children, right? And those women will come back with a vengeance. And so that I kept thinking of that as I was reading this chapter about the decisions that Kat has made and will continue to make to protect her children. Mm. Really starting with the capture of Tyrion, which we could say is maybe not the best decision in hindsight.
All right. Now this gets a little prickly. Okay. So, all right. So Kat, we all love Kat, right? We all think that she's the best, right? And yet there's something about her making the decision. Well, first she makes the decision, I'm going to support Rob first and foremost, right? Arya's going to have to get the short end of the stick here, right? Arya's going to have to marry a Frey boy and move to the twins. This is like a... This is horrible for Arya, right? But it's what Ned needs. It's what Edmure Tully needs. It's what Rob needs. And so she chooses the men in her life, the well-being of the men in her life, and Arya is sort of the trading chip to do this. But then secondly, she makes the choice for Rob. And it's possible that if, how do I say this? Rob is holding this promise to Walder Frey very lightly because it wasn't his own promise. It was his mother's promise. And I wonder if there's something about that that comes back and bites Kat in the end, because...
I think it would be quite harsh to judge her in that sense. Because, I mean, they've already sacrificed one daughter for the greater good, haven't they? I mean, Sansa's already been dispatched off to King's Landing. And that's in part because Robert wants that, but it's also to make better connections with the Crown, but also with the Lannisters and things as well. So marrying off Arya is not necessarily that much of a sacrifice. It's what needs to be done. I mean, surely it's back to your original point, Anthony. I suppose it's perhaps Rob's marriage is the greater sacrifice because he's the heir. I mean, that opens up possibilities for Frey interference in the North down the line, and that's not to, you know, not to sell out poor old Arya, who as you say would be stuck with a Frey husband, but you know, politically speaking, I suppose it's Rob's marriage that is the greater sacrifice, I suppose, if you think in those terms. I think that's it makes perfect sense that she does that. I'm not sure that's, I think it's all Rob's fault. Rob can't keep it in his pants.
Okay, that's right.
That's the reason it all falls apart.
That's right. Rob can't keep it in his pants. And I think that's, it's like she's playing all the politics correctly, right? What's her undoing? Her 15-year-old son's libido is her undoing, right? Shouldn't we have seen this coming? You know, is this so hard to anticipate here? It seems like maybe it is. Maybe it's like, look, you do your best, you make the best moves, political moves that you can, and it just, you're just not going to be able to hold back the chaos. And part of the chaos has to do with the fact that the entire North is ruled by this 15-year-old boy.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it, Anthony. It raises the question that another one of Catelyn's vulnerabilities is not only is she adhering to the old way, as has been discussed, but she seems to routinely underestimate the power of people's emotions. Again, we're back to Frey, where she's like, okay, here are all these, he has all these grievances. Well, I'll do this, 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 and this, and this. But as we've discussed, that doesn't change the emotional reality. And she does something similar with Rob. It's like, okay, well, he's going to, you know, Ari's going to do this. She's going to marry him. And Rob, you're going to do this. And exactly, he's 15. She's surrounded by men. She knows how men operate. The chances are good that he isn't going to be able to keep it in his pants, to quote Ian. So she kind of discounts emotion on a regular basis, it seems to me.
That's right. At the end of the chapter, Rob doesn't flinch. He doesn't pause. He says, do I have to make this choice? If you want to cross, yes. He says, then let's do it. And the fact that he doesn't pause, that he doesn't flinch, it says like she's never been prouder of him, right? Because, you know, he's evincing wisdom. Is that how we should read Rob? Or is he just going to say whatever he needs to say to get across that bridge? Because clearly he doesn't hold that promise as dearly as Kat would have. So is she right to be proud of him? He says yes without flinching. Is it because he's sort of the model of wisdom, or is it because he's a 15-year-old boy and he's just going to say whatever his mom wants to hear right now?
I just was going to interject again. I'm still not completely convinced that regardless of what Rob does, Frey is not going to do what he does. And I just keep thinking, was Rob's action, his betrayal of the promise, was that the cause of Frey's action or the excuse for it? And, you know, you mentioned guests, right? The idea that Frey is so bold, right? And you know, even if in the South, it's maybe not quite as adhered to, everybody is still kind of shocked when that happens, right? Catelyn even feels safe walking in there thinking, oh, we've had the bread, we've had the salt, we're okay. Does that give Frey more license to say, well, maybe I can get by with breaking guess right because Rob already betrayed me. This then gives me further ability to go ahead and pretty much do what I want to do anyway, regardless of what I told Kat. So again, certainly others could point to evidence that this is not the case, but I just get this feeling that even if Rob had married the Frey daughter, I still think Frey would have looked for any excuse to just stick it to the Tullys, right? To stick it to that lineage. And then the other thing I keep thinking about too, as we're talking, is I may be remembering this incorrectly. So somebody else correct me if I'm wrong about this, but doesn't Rob decide to marry, is it Jen Poole? It's not Jen Poole. Who does he end up marrying?
Show, it's Talisa. In the book, it is someone named Jane. It's not Poole.
It's not Poole. Jen or Jane or I'm so sorry, like, I can't remember her name. But it almost seems to me that he marries her almost out of spite for what Kat did in releasing Jamie. So I was thinking when you were talking, Stephanie, about emotion. I think you're right. Kat is very solid in this chapter. We have to do what we have to do. We can't let emotion get involved. I can't go to Bran like I want to because I think I can help Rob more.
Yeah.
I have to think very logically. And yet, as the chapters go on, she falls victim to that very emotion.
Right.
She stops thinking strategically, and she thinks in terms of Rob may hate me. He may even punish me for this. But if I want my girls back, I have to release Jamie. And I know what the consequences, and think about the chain of events that happens. After she releases Jamie, the Karstarks are furious because they want vengeance for what Jamie did to their sons. And that just, it's like dominoes, right? Rob begins to lose the loyalty of his men. And that's really where the people like Roose Bolton, aha, things are turning. I'm going to go with whoever I think can give me the most power. That's what Frey starts to think. Oh, he's losing that support. I'm going to run over to the Lannisters, right? So you've got these actors like Theon, like Frey, like Bolton. They're just watching. They're watching to see how the winds blow. And when things start to fall apart for Rob, they attack. That's when they're able to move in on those weaknesses. Things are really never the same again. I think both in terms of the loyalty that Rob used to have from his men after Jamie's released, and the relationship between Kat and Rob really suffers from that. And again, I may be wrong, but I got the feeling the last time I read those chapters that it's almost like Rob saying, you know what? I'm going to do what I want to do because you have committed the greatest act of disloyalty to your son and really to your Lord, right? Ned's dead at this point. That's just the feeling I got, that it's more of, and it's very reckless. It is the act of an immature son saying, my mother did something I don't like. Guess what?
It's always both. Just speaking as someone who was a boy once, it's that this is attractive. The fact that it also gets back at mom or gets back at dad, that's icing, right? So it's like, yes, of course, I looked up the name. It's Jane Westerling.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. So, it was a J something.
Right. So he, of course, he is in love with Jane Westerling, right? But he's also pissed off at mom. So
I think that's such a great point, Jan, that release of Jamie, based on the very emotional decision about the daughters. And that's interesting. You're right. That's such a huge decision and turning point, and has all of these kind of nuclear effects on everybody else.
That's a great point, Jan. And yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way myself. I suppose I was thinking of it, you know, that Catelyn makes the comment several times in the chapter of, is he a Stark? Is he his father? How much is he a Stark? And I think the marriage arrangement and her reaction to his reaction, you know, when she tells him that he's going to be married off, seems to confirm in her mind that he is a Stark, but actually it's not as straightforward as that. You know, there is perhaps a generational divide, that the children are not necessarily their parents. And you know, the point I made already, that the idea of Callan and Ned being kind of old fashioned in their views, perhaps that hasn't extended to the children necessarily. Perhaps Rob is not quite as immersed in that, or doesn't quite think that way. And so, he's not his father in that, because his father would have absolutely have stuck to that oath, even if it was arranged for him. His sure. own personal sense of what's right and what's fair would have meant that he would have absolutely seen that through. And Rob doesn't do that. So I think in that sense, Rob isn't his father.
Right. And everything, you know, these all are decisions that we make. There's always sort of the decision you make before you're in love and the decision you make after you're in love. It's like everything makes sense. You know, your whole life is on track. You're making good life decisions. And then, of course, you fall in love and then logic just falls apart. And you start like rearranging things in your mind to make it make sense. I mean, it's a very human problem. Yeah. And of course, if you're the lord of a great region, then your particular problems become a lot of people's problems, right? This is not just Rob's relationship with Kat. It's his relationship with the Freys and the Tullys and all of that business, you know. Edmure has to marry a Frey now that Rob has decided he's not going to marry a Frey. You know, as a lord, his decisions, his boyhood mistakes become a lot of people's mistakes.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun fan favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advance feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
There was one thing I noted in this chapter that I really loved, and I tried to find it so I could read it to you, but I made the note. So Kat just found out that her brother Edmure is cornered, and her husband is in jail, and Rob is forced to one side of a river. And so all of this information comes to her, and there's this line that said, "A cold hand clutched her heart." And I thought, oh, this is a nice little foreshadowing to the Lady Stoneheart stuff. But why does the cold hand clutch her heart? It's that someone has menaced her family. That is what's going to be her trigger. So if you start to menace Kat's family, she absolutely will go Lady Stoneheart on you.
Much like a lot of the women, again, you know, the mothers in the story, I kept thinking of that again and again, that is the trigger, right? Yeah. That they might negotiate and stay in the shadows and do their duty. But again, you mess with the kids. And a lot of men, I think, in this story underestimate how powerful the need to protect the children is on the part of these women. You know, you and I, Anthony, talked about the Cersei Ned conversation, just the underestimating of I don't care who I kill. I don't care who I step on. The children will come first. Right. Even if I have to, in Lysa's case, kill my own husband, the child will come first.
Right. And in that conversation, Ned immediately thinks about Kat, right? He immediately thinks, oh yeah, that's right. What would Kat do? What Kat would do. She might even do something worse. Like he's immediately thinking, oh, I understand Cersei a little bit better now because I'm married to a woman who absolutely will, protect her children in the same way.
Yeah.
So I think I think in that way, Cersei helps us sort of understand Kat a little bit better in that chapter.
And isn't it interesting that we're talking about motherhood in this chapter where we've got this whole clan that are motherless because there's Frey on to wife number 8.
Right.
So there's no mother taking care of all those 150 people.
Yes. The
Freys
have problems because of the mothers keep dying. Is this an exaggeration, Ian? I was thinking with Frey, it's like, okay, 8 wives? Come on. 8? Really? 8 wives? Come on.
It does suggest he's going through them at quite a rate. It does suggest, although if they're having so many children, then I presume there's quite a few lost to childbirth. I think eight wives would be an extreme, to be honest. Although you get several noble women and indeed queens who have, you know, three or four husbands. They have the misfortune of either marrying older men or their husbands are killed or dying. Whatever circumstances, and end up being married three or four times. I'm trying desperately to remember the examples, and I typically can't. But you know, there's one example I looked at recently, and yes, it's like four marriages, none of which seem to be happy. What a miserable existence.
Right.
And is this Frey's kind of way of overcompensating, right, for his own lack of power and prestige? Well, I'm just going to have as many children as I can.
Right.
And how many times does he say to Kat in that conversation, "You have how many sons? I'll give you 100 of mine compared to your," right? He's constantly bragging about how I basically have built my own army just by exploiting all of these young women and having all of these children. That's how I'm, you know, amassing power and showing my strength. So it's just yet another way for him to find that advantage.
Yeah. The only lord who can field an army out of his own breeches is what Kat's father said.
But it all sounds so petty as well, because it's meaningless. You know, he compares himself to Tywin Lannister. He's like, "Oh, it doesn't matter about all these gold. I've got all these sons." Yes. You know, it doesn't matter.
And yet that's his problem, right? That's, you know, he thinks that that's going to bring him political capital, right? You know, I'll have a bunch of sons. I'll make a bunch of alliances. I'm going to use these sons for political capital. And yet he can't do it. He can't. He has too many to actually use these children in the way he wants to use them.
Catelyn makes that point herself when she says, you know, one of his sons is married to a Lannister daughter, but in the end, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. You know, it doesn't mean he's more loyal to the Lannisters or more dangerous because of that, because Frey himself doesn't necessarily know.
So this brings up a very, I underlined a word that I had never seen before in this chapter, and that is the word grand bastard. This is only for Walder Frey. This is a word that was invented for Walder Frey. That he doesn't just have bastards, he has grand bastards. And I started to look it up a little bit, and I thought, no, this is Martin invented this for Walder Frey. So anyway, I like that. Notable introductions in this chapter. This title, Lord of the Crossing, we have not seen this before. Speaking of grand bastards, we meet Rhaegar and Ronald Rivers for the first time. And we hear Loras Tyrell called Sir Daisy for the first time. And I think because we've all seen the show, Loras' sexuality is sort of on the surface. But in the books, there are just these little hints that suggest that some people read him as effeminate. And you read closely and you think, oh yeah, no, Loras and Renly might have something happening, but it's all very subtle. And this is one of those hints that the Frey boys have invented this name for Loras or Daisy. So I thought that was an interesting little note.
Yeah.
Show differences. Some of Kat's words are given to one of the Northern Lords. She says this in the book, she says, "Expect nothing of Walder Frey and you'll never be surprised." Right? So that's an interesting reading of Walder Frey. But in the show, they give that line to, you know, one of the Bannermen. Did you notice any differences that seemed interesting or notable?
So I don't remember. Anybody else?
No, I'm afraid I forgot to look. Sorry.
Okay, so here's a major... This is a sort of a context thing. But this scene where Kat goes in to negotiate with Walder Frey, this happens in an episode titled Baylor, which is season 1, episode 9, completely overshadowed by one of the major events in television history. Mm-hmm. Ned gets his head chopped off. And so because that overshadows everything, there are other things about that episode that are actually really important. We actually get a setup for the Red Wedding in that episode. But Ned's demise, surprising, shocking demise, really become, it really eclipses all of those other conversations. Yeah. So I noted, I went back and I watched it yesterday. What an amazing moment. What an amazing show. It's just, that first season was remarkable. So
I remember we had started watching the series. It had been out maybe 2 or 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And as so often happens, I don't start watching a show until my students say, I can't believe you haven't seen this. Why aren't you watching this? And so this is back when we had DVDs. Yeah. I had a student who, after I admitted to a group that, sorry, I've heard of Game of Thrones, but I've never watched it. He actually came in the next day, handed me his entire DVD collection to that point and said, you must start watching this show. So my husband and I started watching in bits and pieces. And that episode came on and I was wide awake. I was really into it. For some reason, I fell asleep. And I fell asleep just as they were leading Ned out. And I remember waking up and I looked at my husband. And I said, oh my God, did they kill Ned Stark? Right. Surely not. And he said, yes, they killed Ned Stark. And I remember just thinking, I can't believe that was the moment I fell asleep. So I kind of had to rewind it and watch it again. Are we sure that they actually killed Ned Stark? And of course, you know, it was such a shock not knowing anything about the story really at that point. You think Sean Bean, he's going to be the star of this whole show and he's Ned, you know, he's pivotal to what's going on. And that was kind of our first hint with Martin that you can't trust that just because you have a main character, this character will survive. Yeah. And so then the rest of the time you're watching, you're just thinking at some point your most beloved characters don't get too attached because at some point they may just be lopped off.
That's right.
And that was the case.
Martin really takes the kill your darlings advice to writers seriously.
All men must die.
Okay, I'm going to kill them all.
And being a writer, Stephanie, what was your relationship to that, Stephanie? Because you're aware of these plot devices and these tropes. I mean, were you prepared at all for that? Or were you shocked like so many others?
I was very shocked by it. But it's interesting, Anthony, that thank you for reminding us kind of how that episode works, because the showrunners are actually including the chapter after ours, because the chapter after the one we're looking at is the Jon Snow chapter where he gets the sword.
That's right.
And then has the conversation with Father Aemon, which is also back to Ian's point about loyalty.
Right.
Yes.
Loyalty versus love. Loyalty versus emotion.
John wants to
leave. Love is the death of loyalty. Right. What is it? Love is the death of duty. Something like
that.
Yes. Right.
Yes. And John makes the right choice there, right? He's not led by his emotions. He stays. He honors his commitment to his brothers, which says a lot about what we're going to learn about John going forward.
So now that we're in the thick of it, and maybe we can wrap up on this one, but I'm curious to hear you reflect on this. It's hard to find the climax of this book. It was not hard to find the climax of season one. It was Ned got his head chopped off. That is the climax of the show. In the book, we see that event from Arya's perspective, and Arya doesn't see the event. In the book, Arya comes into the courtyard. She's witnessing what's happening on the stage, and Yoren grabs her and covers her eyes so she can't see what actually happens. So she hears it, bring me his head. But it's almost an off-screen event. We later hear Sansa reflect on the event, but it's a very odd way to portray the climax of the story. And that almost makes me think, and maybe in the book, the climax is when Littlefinger puts the knife to Ned's throat and says, I told you not to trust me. Because, you know, that you know, right before this chapter, Ned gets his last POV chapter. Ned is like out of the story basically at this point as a POV character. I don't know. How do we measure, like, maybe it's too arbitrary to find one or whatever, but is it really the climax? Is Ned's beheading really the climax if we don't actually see it happen in the book?
I think what we're seeing is the big difference between visual storytelling and text. in television in particular, no matter how avant-garde the TV show is, there's a, you know, there's a narrative arc that you have to have, and there has, there kind of has to be a climax.
Right.
Particularly, and this, again, the show was made a few years ago. We haven't gotten to some of the more interesting TV shows like The Good Place and TV shows that kind of resist those moves. But so the showrunners are going to give you the big climax. As to the book, that's an interesting question as to what the kind of the big climax in this book is. It might be a little finger saying, I told you not to trust me. I'm not sure. What do other folks think?
I think the way you described it, Anthony, in terms of the TV show, I think, yeah, that was, it was obviously set up. Ned's death was meant to be the pivotal moment. And yes, as Stephanie said, that, you know, killing your main character and things. Although I suppose I was going to say we should have known that was coming because Sean Bean always dies.
That's true.
So true. We should have known.
I had totally forgotten that. You're exactly right.
Poor Sean.
But no, I'm sure he gets paid rather well if I get killed off a lot. But in terms of the books, I don't know. I mean, is it actually this part of the storyline at all? Is it not Daenerys? Daenerys' thread that's actually setting things up? Is the kind of, you know, her resurrection and that's the end point, and that sets us up for what's to come, because actually her story will really kick into gear
right
in the next books, and it's actually not perhaps on the west,
sure, but... yeah, no, or you could look at sort of Jon Snow saving Lord Mormont from the zombie or whatever.
Yeah,
it's like a little magic trick to make you look at Ned really long and really, you know, make Ned interesting enough so that you're not actually reading the story for the sort of ice and fire big narrative arc issues. But I almost see that those issues, and maybe it is Daenerys's resurrection, maybe that's a good point, but I almost see that that this book is almost a setup for that longer Song of Ice and Fire stuff. I feel like in this book, absolutely, Ned can be thought of as the main character. He has the most words, he has the most chapters, he's the detective of the detective novel. That's what Ned is meant to be. So
I want to go back to the ending, and then I want to maybe address your question to you, Anthony, because in rereading this, those last two chapters of this book, wow. I even wrote in the margin, what an ending.
I know.
Right? Because you've got the great Keen in the North moment, right? Where it's just really setting Rob up almost to be kind of, here's Ned's successor. If we've lost Ned, surely in the next book, Rob, but even Rob is not the centerpiece of the next book. We take a different turn, which I remember the first time I read these thinking, oh, where's the big Rob centrism that I kind of expected in the next book? And he's always kind of a shadowy character, you know, very different from the show, right? Where Rob is very centered. In the books, he's always kind of seen through other people's perspective and point of view. But I appreciate what you're saying, Anthony, about climax, because you're right. In going back and looking for that chapter where Ned is beheaded in the book, you almost can't find it. Yeah. You have to really look closely to say, oh, there's the moment Ned is beheaded, because it's not
accented in the same way. I had to reread it a couple times. I thought, wait, no, you missed it. You missed it.
Yeah, it's an Arya chapter. You're right. It's not even Ned's perspective. Right. It's told from her perspective. So I think you're right in the sense that really once Littlefinger betrays him, puts the knife to his neck, you do see Ned kind of receding in terms of point of view, in terms of importance. It's almost, and maybe I'm saying this because I know in hindsight what happens, but it's almost kind of predetermined at that point that Ned made a huge mistake in calculation. He confronted Cersei, he trusted Littlefinger, two fatal mistakes, and now it's almost kind of inevitable, right, what will happen to Ned, even if you're still shocked that, oh, wow, they killed off a major character. Mm-hmm. But he does kind of fade after that point, and others come to prominence, I think, kind of in his place. It's interesting that Arya is the point of view for when Ned is killed, maybe foreshadowing how key she will become to the story.
Sure.
I think this is, despite everything that happens, this is still largely the kind of time of peace. This is, apart from, you know, armies wandering around towards the end, but it's still peacetime in Westeros. it's all going to go to hell after this. Yeah. The gloves are going to come off. And the rest of the narrative is through an extended period of war. Yes. And there is I think you can see when you compare the events, even though there's plenty of blood and violence in the first series in the first book, but it's nothing compared to what's going to come after.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminded me of the other time. I mean, there's a many moments in this story when the fates of many are decided by a teenage boy, right? Joffrey just says, bring me his head. And what can you, like, nothing can be done at this point. You put a kid on the throne, and if he says, bring me his head, that in that moment, you have to chop off the guy's head. And of course, that like you said, Ian, it throws everything into chaos in the same way that, you know, later on, Rob will decide that he's going to marry for love, and that throws everything to chaos.
Yeah. Do you think Jamie sets the tone, right? When he says, right before he throws Bran out the window, the things we do for love.
Right.
And that so motivates so many of the characters. I'm thinking of Drogo too, right? Yeah. Where he is motivated. He seems more loyal toward the end in pleasing Daenerys. And she was right, of course. They shouldn't have been doing what they were doing and pillaging and abusing these women. But his blood riders look at him and say, you're listening to her over your own men. And that's his kind of fatal flaw. Now, of course, it sets into motion what she then goes on to do. But here's Drogo, this powerful warrior, in the end is motivated more by love. And it's what leads to his downfall.
That's right. That's why he decides to go to conquest in Westeros. He doesn't want to go across the sea. But as soon as someone attempts to assassinate his wife,
that's it.
It's that moment of fire in his belly that makes him think, you're going to see. And even Dany in that chapter, someone just woke the dragon. Like, she uses that phrase of herself. Again, youthful, impetuous, youthful decisions made in like a moment of passion.
Yes.
Changed the fate of so many people. Thank you all so much for this little experiment. I just felt like so many things could have gone wrong, and the fact that nothing went wrong, I'm kind of amazed. So I feel really grateful to you and for this whole thing actually working.
My this is fun.
Gratitude.
We should
thank
do it again.
Anthony. Thank you, Ian and Jan. This was really fun.
Thanks, everybody.
Awesome. Thank you very much.